Thank you. Okay, so thank you for the invitation. It's very nice to be here. I'm especially excited to be at an institute that has cognition in its name as a cognitive science. I'm currently affiliated with child and adolescent psychiatry, which is a bit outside of my area of expertise, even though in terms of topic it kind of fits well. So I've been asked to do this experience, talk about pre-registration. So first I will just recap what is pre-registration, especially as opposed to registered reports. So we've just heard about the experience with registered reports. Julia has talked both about registered reports and pre-registrations, but I just wanted to highlight the similarities and differences. So both have the advantage that they defend against p-hacking because you need to specify in advance exactly what you will do. Well, both of them defend against publication bias, although I have written a question mark for pre-registration here, because even though you do have a publicly accessible record of conducting this study, but there is no guarantee that it will actually be published in a journal. Both of them defend against hacking, so hypothesizing after the results are known, again, because you pre-specify everything in advance. One thing that you get with registered reports, but not pre-registration, is the guarantee of publication. With a quality check before data collection, you get that with registered reports through the peer review during this stage one submission process. I've written a question mark again for pre-registration, which is something that I will talk about later. So this is not something that happens by default, unlike with registered reports. Finally, for both of them, you can get the badge, like this pre-registration badge that was, I think, flashed on one of the slides of Julia's, as I remember. So you might be wondering, given all the things that you get with registered reports and not pre-registration, why even bother doing pre-registration? And the point here is this final point. So as we've just heard, registered reports do take a lot of time. I think it's worth it in the long run, but of course there are situations when that's just not feasible. For example, if you know that data collection is going to take a lot of time, you have a PhD or a postdoc contract, 2-3 years, then sometimes you just don't have the luxury of being able to do a registered report, even if you would really like to. So here, pre-registration is a very good alternative. So what is a pre-registration? Again, I will just very briefly recap. We've already heard that it's a time-stamped and non-modifiable record of what you are planning to do in a study, basically. Unlike registered report, the format is a bit more flexible, so the report doesn't have to be an exact copy of what you will then see as the introduction in the final version of the paper. So you're a bit more flexible with the format. Of course, you can write the full report, but in principle, you can even just write it in bullet points. It's not peer-reviewed, that's the big difference. I just put that here again because it's the very big, the very important difference with registered reports. There are many platforms, so Julia has already talked about that, where you can publish them. And again, the important thing, this has been said, but because it's very, very, very important, I've decided to put that here again. As well, so you need to upload this report before you start data collection. And then with the pre-registration, basically, you have your pre-registration, you do the study, and then you submit the study as you just would with any other paper, and you include a link to the pre-registration in the final manuscript, so both the reviewers and the readers can check whether you actually did what you promised to do. So where do I start? I hope everybody is now really enthusiastic to go out and do some pre-registration or registered reports. So in theory, it's extremely simple. So we have our typical research cycle here, and basically just at this point, after you've acquired your materials and designed your study, you just upload the preprint and then you proceed as normally. In practice, it's not as easy, otherwise I guess I would not have much to talk about. So at this stage, I need to make a bit of a confession. I haven't actually published a pre-registered study in a peer-reviewed journal. So how come I have pre-registered 5 projects to date? You can see then I pre-register everything on the Open Science Framework. So I have, like here, I can see all of my registrations. I have these 5 projects. None of them are published, so what happened? So basically, for the first project that I ever pre-registered, I published it as a preprint, so it was rejected by a journal because they wanted some follow-up experiments, and I kind of didn't have the time and resources to run those. For another 3 projects, I got uninterpretable null results. So after I ran the study, I looked at the results and I thought, well, it doesn't really tell us anything. Nobody's going to publish that. And then with the final one, I am actually hoping that I will publish that eventually. I still need to do some data analysis and write up the paper, but I have some hopes that that will work. So basically, I'm in the best position to tell you how not to do a pre-registration. Which is what I want to do today. So there are some rookie mistakes that if you are just kind of like what I did, you are used to doing the standard studies and then you just go out and say, well, it would be fun to do a pre-registration, then there are just some mistakes that I guess people commonly use. The first rookie mistake is to have a flawed design, which is something that no matter how good you are as a researcher, there are always going to be things that you didn't think about or that you overlooked. So with registered reports, it's much more important than for other types of studies to make sure that you avoid that. So one thing to do is to do pilot testing. So perhaps if you run a couple of participants with a flawed design, then you will realize, okay, that's something that's not working really well. The other thing is something like to build as closely as possible on work that has already been published, because we tend to want to try out new things, but with these kinds of new things, it's always difficult if they don't work to interpret exactly why that didn't work. One thing that you can try, so if you remember from my first slide, I said that you don't get peer review, and that's true, you don't get peer review from a journal for this registered report, but you can try some do-it-yourself peer review. So just send your report before you upload it to your friends, to your colleagues, and to your enemies, especially to your enemies, and ask them, okay, so do you have any feedback on the design? How can I improve this? Will you be convinced by the results? If you are really brave, you can also just upload your report as a preprint and advertise it through social media, ask if anybody has any feedback. But of course, that's, I say, for the brave, because I guess many people will not do this because out of fear that their idea will be scooped. So, rookie mistake number 2. This is what happened with 3 of those studies that I'd circled in red. You design a study and then you get some uninterpretable null results. So how does this happen? So this happens, I think, quite a lot for experiment ideas that I call shower ideas. Like you just think, okay, so wouldn't it be cool to do this experiment? And wouldn't it be cool if this and this happened? With these kinds of studies, the thing is that if it happens, then yes, it's really awesome and it's really amazing. But if it doesn't happen, it's kind of like one example is this precognition set of studies by BEM. So basically, he conducted some studies that showed that undergraduate students can predict with above chance probability which stimuli they would be shown after they were tested. So basically, that they had some clairvoyant powers, which is the kind of power, which is the kind of study that, yes, if you really found convincing evidence that people can foresee the future, that would be amazing. But if you find a null result, then people are kind of going like, why did you even conduct this study? Of course, nobody will want to publish that. That's an extreme example, of course. But I think this kind of thing happens a lot with, at least in my experience with my own experiments. So how you can avoid these kinds of studies is firstly to really think through this theory. So think about the if you get a null result in your study, would that actually be something that informs the theory? Are there different theories that make predictions. Maybe one theory says there should be an effect and the other theory says there should be no effect. The second thing is to maximize the strength of the manipulation. So that was actually one of the mistakes I made in one of my studies. The manipulation was some exposure. So before doing the experiment, one half of the participants was exposed to some stimuli and the other half was not. But the exposure was basically just one round of seeing, so each stimulus just once. So perhaps if I had shown them this these exposure stimuli 10 times or 20 times instead, I would have had a significant result. So then including manipulation checks, again, for my exposure study, this could be something like at the end of the experiment, they need to rate the stimuli and some stimuli that did not occur for familiarity, even though it had nothing to do with the experimental manipulation, but just to, with the experimental, with the actual research question, but just to make sure that the exposure phase did have achieved the effect of participants actually being more familiar with the stimuli that they were exposed to. The other thing that's very important is adequate sample size, which is important in any case, but especially with registered reports, you need to justify your sample size as a matter of routine. And of course, if you do an experiment on you're looking for a tiny effect and you have a tiny sample size, then a null result is not going to tell you very much at all. So rookie mistake number three is promising things that you can't keep. Again, one thing to get around that is to do some pilot testing. For example, if you're doing a learning study, then you want to make sure that the participants are actually able to learn the material that you want them to learn. Otherwise, it kind of doesn't work. In terms of sample size, I have only just told you that it is important to have adequate sample size. But it is also important to consider what is and is not realistic. So when we're really being honest, so of course the way to go, at least within the frequentist framework, is to do a power analysis. We know that if we do a power analysis based on the published literature, probably we will get a very optimistic estimate because of things like publication bias and p-hacking that kind of only the things with unusually large effect sizes survive. So if we really correct for that, if we are really honest and we do power calculation, we will get sample sizes quite often that are just not realistic within a PhD or postdoc project, let's say. So how to get around that? One possibility is to do sequential testing. So I guess you will get access to the slides, so you can. There are these very nice tutorials, both for a frequentist approach and for a Bayesian approach, on how to do the sequential testing. But basically, you determine a maximum number of participants that you are able to test, and you, depending on which approach you want to do, basically you can test until you get a significant result or until you get support either for or against your hypothesis in the Bayesian framework, but you need to correct for multiple comparisons, of course. So these are some very nice tutorials on how to do that. You can also argue based on practical considerations, especially if you are doing studies with some special population that is not so easy to recruit. But here it is important to argue as well that your sample size corresponds to what is generally done, or even better, that your sample size is larger than what is generally done in your field. In that case, I think even if you say, well, I know it's going to be underpowered, but that's just the best I can do, and I will make the data available for some future cumulative analysis, in that case, I think that should be still a good way to do it. Another thing that, I made this mistake, I heard about this fancy data processing trimming technique, and I wrote in the pre-registration that I want to do it, and then I got my data. And then I realized there was an R package that did exactly this trimming method, but somehow it didn't work. So I I couldn't keep my promise to trim my data in this way. which is not a disaster. You can, of course, justify it in the final manuscript, but it's just a bit embarrassing. So that's something that you can avoid. By practicing all of the ways that you want to process and analyze your data beforehand. For example, if you have pilot data, you can use the pilot data for this. If you don't have pilot data, you can just simulate some data and write an R script, which is really good actually, because in addition to making sure that you know what you're doing, you can also upload the R script then along with your pre-registration, and that's one way to specify even in more detail what you are going to do in your data analysis. Okay, so I told you about all the things that you shouldn't do. So if you do want to do a registered report, what do you actually do? Where do you start? So I would say it's okay to start with small steps. So I think with open science, there's a lot of this kind of implicit expectation that people either do everything or nothing, which I think is a really big pity, because there are things that you can do that take very little effort and that are already a big step towards open science and are very helpful both for yourself and for the scientific community in general. So I would really recommend that everybody should write a pre-registration for every single study that they conduct, even just as an exercise, even just to see, even just to get an idea, because when you start really writing these pre-registered reports, you realize how many decisions you do need to make. And so that's a very interesting exercise, even if you don't want to do a formal pre-registration for a given study. So I think this has been said before as well, formal pre-registration doesn't always make sense. So if you want to try something completely new, maybe it's not the best idea. You can just try it out and then treat your pilot data from your completely new design as a pilot. Or if you have an exploratory study, then it's also maybe not worth pre-registering it. The question that you should really ask yourself is, will my study allow me to draw conclusions regardless what happens, regardless of the results? Collecting pilot data is very important, as I've stressed throughout multiple slides. Get as much feedback as possible to avoid having some mistakes that you may have overlooked and your collaborators may have overlooked. As Julia has already said, the more detail, the better. So very vague registered report is still better than no registered report, but of course it's even better to just have a full-fledged report that specifies everything that you are going to do. Then once you have done the pre-registration, once you have collected the data, well, even during the data collection, you should bear in mind that as far as I know, through Cortex, the registered reports, for example, that have been published through Cortex, all of them have required some modifications to the design and analysis. So this is perfectly normal. So be aware that you are not going to follow what you did down to the last letter, but that's perfectly fine, as long as you describe what you did differently and why you did that. So I will leave you with this slide. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Xenia, for the talk. Is there a clarification question for Xenia? If not, I would like to ask the speakers to sit here, the speakers of this session, and you can now bring up your general questions regarding registered report and pre-registrations.